Namaste. Good morning, good evening. We continue in Brahman, Purusha, Ishvara, Maya Prakriti Shakti tonight. We have come to a point where Sri Aurobindo has begun the description of three essential powers and possibilities of the infinite divine consciousness. So we continue with a paragraph that begins, a second possibility of the infinite consciousness that must be admitted is its power of self-limitation or secondary self-formation into a subordinate movement within the integral, illimitable consciousness and knowledge. For that is a necessary consequence of the power of self-determination of the infinite. So if the divine, as a conscious being, has mastery of itself, it must be capable of limiting its being, of compressing its infinity into a finite form if it wishes to do that. Each self-determination of the self-being must have its own awareness of its self-truth and its self-nature. Or, if we prefer so to put it, the being in that determination must be so self-aware. Spiritual individuality means that each individual self or spirit is a center of self-vision and all vision. The circumference, the boundless circumference, as we may say, of this vision may be the same for all, but the center may be different. Not located as in a spatial point in a spatial circle, but a psychological center, related with others through a coexistence of the diversely conscious many in the universal being. Each being in a world will see the same world, but see it from its own self-being, according to its own way of self-nature. For each will manifest its own truth of the infinite, its own way of self-determination and of meeting the cosmic determinations. Its vision by the law of unity in variety will no doubt be fundamentally the same as that of others, but it will still develop its own differentiation, as we see all human beings conscious in the one human way of the same cosmic things, yet always with an individual difference. This self-limitation would be not fundamental, but an individual specialization of a common universality or totality. The spiritual individual would act from his own center of the one truth and according to his self-nature, but on a common basis and not with any blindness to other self and other nature. So here he describes the ideal individual, you might say, as formed in the supramental consciousness, where individuality has a special and unique perspective, but always within the context of the whole. It is a member of the all, conscious of the all, at the same time that it is conscious of itself, sharing the same world. Contrast this with the nature of the ego, which is divided from others, divided indeed from the world, and seeks to have some association with both the reality around, some kind of understanding of itself, and staring perplexedly at whatever may be beyond world and self. So here Sri Aurobindo is describing the individual as a possibility within the self-limitation of the divine's powers. So the capacity to restrict itself. But it would be consciousness limiting its action with full knowledge, not a movement of ignorance. But apart from this individualizing self-limitation, there must also be in the consciousness of the infinite a power of cosmic limitation. It must be able to limit its actions so as to base a given world or universe and to keep it in its own order, harmony, self-building. For the creation of a universe necessitates a special determination of the infinite consciousness to preside over that world and a holding back of all that is not needed for that movement. So, the cosmic order is a formation of this restrictive divine consciousness, placing some part of its being and nature into it, holding back what is not needed. There is no need to invest in the world more than is necessary for its manifestation and development. This infinite consciousness not only manifests it, that is to say, makes it clear, makes it come into view, but presides over it. At the same time, that cosmic order is constituted of its being. So it is, even though vast in its extent, still a restriction of its vast awareness as the infinite. It is a restricted distribution of its being and power into action. This is the nature of the cosmic self-limitation, because there is a cosmic self just as there is the self standing at the center of the individual. It is, yes, the same self, but in two different poises. And does that enumerate all the poises? He continues, in the same way, the putting forth of an independent action of some power like mind, life, or matter must have as its support a similar principle of self-limitation. So powers, planes of being are also restrictions of the nature of the divine consciousness. They do not exhaust it coming forth into manifestation. It cannot be said that such a movement must be impossible for the infinite because it is illimitable. On the contrary, this must be one of its many powers, in other words, to express itself, to pour itself into formation, to restrict itself, to manifest in a limited way something of its own being. It must have that power. It cannot be an impotent divinity. It cannot be an infinite which does not include that within it. For its powers, too, are illimitable. But this also, like other self-determinations, other finite buildings, would not be a separation or a real division, for all the infinite consciousness would be around and behind it and supporting it, and the special movement itself would be intrinsically aware, not only of itself, but in essence of all that was behind it. So this idea that it can enter into manifestation, even as an infinite, is contra Advaita, but perfectly within the realm of a dynamic divine. This would be so inevitably in the integral consciousness of the infinite. But we can suppose also that an intrinsic, though not an active awareness of this kind, demarcating itself, yet indivisible, might be there too in the total self-consciousness of the movement of the finite. Intrinsic is a word that means inward or genuine, following an inner law. So this is the nature of the divine consciousness. As it expresses itself from within itself, nothing imposes itself upon the divine from outside. There is no outside. There is only the divine consciousness. And when it wills to move, a manifestation occurs. It is an intrinsic movement, that is to say, it comes out of its own inner being, which means it carries consciousness and will with it, chit shakti. This much cosmic or individual conscious self-limitation would evidently be possible to the infinite and can be accepted by a larger reason as one of its spiritual possibilities. But so far on this basis, any division or ignorant separation or binding and blinding limitation such as is apparent in our own consciousness would be unaccountable. Again, he's speaking here of an interior movement and manifestation occurring within the nature of the conscious being of the divine. This, you might say, is supraconscious, beyond the realm of mind. This dividing mentality that we have cannot see the unity, cannot understand the essentiality that is apparent to the divine, even in self-movement. Essentiality is not lost. It is retained. To the mind, these are irreconcilable opposites. How can it move and be unmoving? How can it be divine and yet enter into mutation? So we've seen then this idea of a power of self-limitation, and now we move on to the third. But a third power or possibility of the infinite consciousness can be admitted. Its power of self-absorption, of plunging into itself, into a state in which self-awareness exists, but not as knowledge and not as all knowledge. The all would then be involved in pure self-awareness, and knowledge in the inner consciousness itself would be lost in pure being. There can be no knowledge if there is no other to know. If the divine does not decide to distribute its oneness into the many, then knowledge cannot arise, even because if there is an extension of self into seemingly other self, it is still the same self, and yet it becomes, as it were, an object which one can know. And then to connect the two, of course, there is knowledge. The knower, the knowledge, the known. In the dynamics of the divine self, this is an undivided reality. At the ignorance of the human level, of course, these seem to be finite and separated things. But here we're speaking about a power of the infinite consciousness to absorb itself into the silence and be unaware of anything at all, not even aware of its oneness. Simple awareness. You might say simplest awareness. This is, luminously, the state which we call the superconscience in an absolute sense, although most of what we call superconscient is in reality not that, but only a higher conscient, something that is conscious to itself and only superconscious to our own limited level of awareness. This self-absorption, this trance of infinity is again no longer luminously but darkly the state which we call the inconscient. For the being of the infinite is there, though by its appearance of inconscience, it seems to us rather to be an infinite non-being. A self-oblivious intrinsic consciousness and force are there in that apparent non-being, For by the energy of the inconscient, an ordered world is created all around us. It is created in a trance of self-absorption. The force acting automatically and with an apparent blindness as in a trance, but still with the inevitability and power of truth of the infinite. And here Sri Aurobindo offers an answer to the cosmic riddle. How can a universe begin? How does it come out of this chaos? Because this power of inconscience is the self-absorbed divine. It has seemingly lapsed into that, but contains all consciousness within it. All the regnant power of the infinite resides there. And as it begins to throw out the world, you can see the order that it creates, even though it is unaware of itself. It is a sign, a symbol, a signature of the divine, which seems to be absent, but is really present. If we take a step further and admit that a special or a restricted and partial action of self-absorption is possible to the infinite, an action not always of its infinity concentrated limitlessly in itself, but confined to a special status or to an individual or cosmic self-determination, we have then the explanation of the concentrated condition or status by which it becomes aware separately of one aspect of its being. So restriction on restriction. So the partial action of self-absorption can make us aware or make being aware of only one aspect of itself, if it so chooses. There can then be a fundamental double status, such as that of the nirguna standing back from the saguna and absorbed in its own purity and immobility, while the rest is held back behind a veil and not admitted within that special status. This again, the power of self-absorbed restriction. So the nirguna, absent apparently to the saguna. In reality, they are the same thing, but they seem to stand as opposite poles. Now remember that all of this is structured within the larger integral divine reality. Nirguna does not hie away into an unattainable void description of being, whatever that might be, beyond mind's capacity to utter it. And saguna is not restricted really to the terms of expression that mind uses to paint a picture of it, satchit ananda. The totality of the infinite consciousness, he says, would be there, not abolished, recoverable, but not evidently active, active only by implication, by inherence, or by the instrumentality of the limited awareness, not in its own manifest power and presence. It will be evident that all these three powers can be accepted as possible to the dynamics of the infinite consciousness. And it is by considering the many ways in which they can work that we may get a clue to the operations of Maya. So the powers of the self, self-formation, self-limitation, self-absorption. The self has the power to throw itself into form. It has the power to restrict itself, to limit itself. It has the power also to absorb itself into any particular poise or pole of being, and there reside oblivious of all the rest of its being, though, of course, everything exists within the larger, all-containing integrality of the divine consciousness. But if we look at these things, he says, we can get a clue to how it is that Maya works. How does this divine consciousness measure out the finite from the infinite? So we continue. This throws light, incidentally, on the opposition made by our minds between pure consciousness, pure existence, pure bliss, and the abundant activity, the manifold application, the endless vicissitudes of being, consciousness, and delight of being that take place in the universe. So, Satchit-Ananda, beyond in its transcendence, how do we reconcile that with the same play of that being, consciousness, and delight here in the mobile universe? He says, in the state of pure consciousness and pure being, we are aware of that only, simple, immutable, self-existent, without form or object, and we feel that to be alone, true, and real. In the other, or dynamic state, we feel its dynamism to be perfectly true and natural, and are even capable of thinking that no such experience as that of pure consciousness is possible. So, if we reside at one pole, the other looks unreal to us. Yet it is now evident that to the infinite consciousness, both the static and the dynamic are possible. These are two of its statuses, and both can be present simultaneously in the universal awareness, the one witnessing the other and supporting it, or not looking at it, and yet automatically supporting it. Or the silence and status may be there, penetrating the activity or throwing it up like an ocean immobile below, throwing up a mobility of waves on its surface. This is also the reason why it is possible for us in certain conditions of our being to be aware of several different states of consciousness at the same time. Because the divine being has stationed itself deliberately at all of these statuses, has invested itself in all of these postures or asanas of being, if you will. And now he goes into the description of a number of states of being which are involved in yogic experience, discoverable to us. There is a state of being experienced in yoga in which we become a double consciousness, one on the surface, small, active, ignorant, swayed by thoughts and feelings, grief and joy and all kinds of reactions. The other within, calm, vast, equal, observing the surface being with an immovable detachment or indulgence, or it may be acting upon its agitation to quiet, enlarge, transform it. So too, we can rise to a consciousness above and observe the various parts of our being, inner and outer, mental, vital, and physical, and the subconscient below all, and act upon one or other or the whole from that higher status. It is possible also to go down from that height or from any height into any of these lower states and take its limited light or its obscurity as our place of working, while the rest that we are is either temporarily put away or put behind, or else kept as a field of reference from which we can get support, sanction, or light, and influence, or as a status into which we can ascend or recede, and from it observe the inferior movements. Or we can plunge into trance, get within ourselves, and be conscious there while all outward things are excluded. Or we can go beyond even this inner awareness and lose ourselves in some deeper other consciousness or some high superconscience. There is also a pervading equal consciousness into which we can enter and see all ourselves with one enveloping glance or omnipresent awareness, one and indivisible. So he's described a number of states of conscious being. The first, Purusha, watching, examining Prakriti, distinct but witnessing. A second, where one is seated above, Udasinata, and can look down upon the whole of the nature below. A third in which there is a yogic descent possible. And this, by the way, is spoken about all throughout the annals of yoga, from the Mahabharata through the Kashmir Shaivism texts, as well as in modern experience with great beings like Sri Ramakrishna, whereby one can descend to any level, position yourself there as yogin or yogini, and take up an active, dynamic life there, absorb oneself, move into oblivion, recover oneself, regain one's liberation, ascend again back to the poise from which one came. There's also the possibility, he says, of an inner absorption of being, of moving inside and living either within the subliminal being, he doesn't name it here, but that's what he's talking about, or something deeper. One can move into a deeper samadhi and a tranced absorption in which all is expunged. One can, opposite that, pervade and move universally in awareness through all these various realms of being at one and the same time, master them with a glance. To continue the paragraph, all this, which looks strange and abnormal or may seem fantastic to the surface reason, acquainted only with our normal status of limited ignorance and its movements, divided from our inner, higher, and total reality, becomes easily intelligible and admissible in the light of the larger reason and logic of the infinite, or by the admission of the greater illimitable powers of the self, the spirit in us, which is of one essence with the infinite. Brahman, the reality, is the self-existent absolute, and Maya is the consciousness and force of this self-existence. But with regard to the universe, Brahman appears as the self of all existence, Atman, the cosmic self, but also as the supreme self, transcendent of its own cosmicity, and at the same time, individual, universal in each being. Maya can then be seen as the self-power, Atma Shakti, of the Atman. This is a powerful sentence because in this sentence, Sri Aurobindo brings all of the true Vedanta into the scope of a single expression. Brahman is real. It is the divine reality. It is Sat, the self-existence. It is an absolute. It is positive being. But also, it is the Chit Shakti, the consciousness and force of that Sat. Sat, Chit, Ananda, remember? This is Sat and Chit. But the self is Brahman as it experiences itself, supporting all, standing at the center of all, an immanent reality to all things. And yet, it is not simply that ground of supporting immanence. It is also transcendent as master of the universe, as the supreme self, who exceeds the cosmic formula, goes beyond the universe, in other words. And then one has to see that it stands as that supreme self in the individual, in the universal, or in the individual universalized, or as the universe individualized in its own person, you see. And so it is that power of the divine. It is Atma Shakti. That means that we inhere in that reality and share as portions or aspects that same great reality of self. It is true that when we first become aware of this aspect, it is usually in a silence of the whole being, or at the least in a silence within which draws back or stands away from the surface action. This self is then felt as a status in silence, an immobile, immutable being, self-existent, pervading the whole universe, omnipresent in all, but not dynamic or active, aloof from the ever-mobile energy of Maya. So this is a first and primary yogic experience, and in fact, it is his own experience. But you can see by the very fact that Sri Aurobindo is writing this, and writing it from a greater experience, that one can move beyond this first experience of the silent self. If I may mention something, the music that we heard tonight was recorded on this date, the 10th of January in 1963 by the mother. I think that it was either in late December or in January of 1908, that I think it was early January 1908 that Sri Aurobindo had his liberating experience in Baroda, in which he realized in 3 days the perfectly silent mind, what he called Brahmic Nirvana, which is being described in this passage here. So, 108 years ago. There's a magic in that number. In the same way, we can become aware of it as the Purusha, separate from Prakriti, the conscious being standing back from the activities of nature. But this is an exclusive concentration which limits itself to a spiritual status and puts away from it all activity in order to realize the freedom of Brahman, the self-existent reality, from all limitation by its own action and manifestation. It is an essential realization, but not the total realization. So the claims of Advaita Vedanta that this is the experience of reality draws an affirmation. Yes, it is, but it is not the only experience of the divine reality. It is essential, but it is not all. For we can see, Sri Aurobindo writes, that the conscious power, the Shakti that acts and creates, is not other than the Maya or all knowledge of Brahman. It is the power of the self. Prakriti is the working of the Purusha, conscious being active by its own nature. The duality, then, of soul and world energy, silent self and the creative power of the spirit, is not really something dual and separate. It is Bayun, two in one. So we find him here tearing down the philosophic wall separating Purusha, the reality of the conscious spirit, from the play of nature as Prakriti, and moving ultimately towards what will be united as Ishvara Ishwari. As we cannot separate fire and the power of fire, it has been said, so we cannot separate the divine reality and its consciousness force, Chit Shakti. This first realization of self as something intensely silent and purely static is not the whole truth of it. There can also be a realization of self in its power, self as the condition of world activity and world existence. However, the self is a fundamental aspect of Brahman, but with a certain stress on its impersonality. Therefore, the power of the self has the appearance of a force that acts automatically with the self sustaining it, witness and support, and originator and enjoyer of its activities, but not involved in them for a moment. This is the nature of the Atma Shakti. As it pours itself out in universal action, it seems to be impersonal. And when we experience it, it is like that. As soon as we become aware of the self, we are conscious of it as eternal, unborn, unembodied, uninvolved in its workings. It can be felt within the form of being, but also as enveloping it, as above it, surveying its embodiment from above, adhyaksha. It is omnipresent, the same in everything, infinite and pure and intangible forever. This is the experience, of course, of Shankara, of Sri Ramana Maharshi. This is an experience that's recorded in the Upanishads, I think, quite strikingly in the Mundaka Upanishad, where it cries out in rapture, you know, Brahman above, Brahman below, Brahman around, etc. All one can experience is that same reality. This self can be experienced as the self of the individual, the self of the thinker, doer, enjoyer. But even so, it always has this greater character. Its individuality is at the same time a vast universality, or very readily passes into that. And the next step to that is a sheer transcendence, or a complete and ineffable passing into the absolute. The self is that aspect of the Brahman in which it is intimately felt as at once individual, cosmic, transcendent of the universe. The realization of the self is the straight and swift way towards individual liberation, a static universality, a nature transcendence. At the same time, there is a realization of self in which it is felt not only sustaining and pervading and enveloping all things, but constituting everything and identified in a free identity with all its becomings in nature. Even so, freedom and impersonalities are always the character of the self. There is no appearance of subjection to the workings of its own power in the universe, such as the apparent subjection of the Purusha to Prakriti. To realize the self is to realize the eternal freedom of the spirit. I think we can put our bookmarks here. We'll rest with this for the evening and come back to the chapter next week and move to a passage in Savitri, which echoes some of what Sri Aurobindo has written here in The Life Divine. This is drawn from Book 1, The Book of Beginnings, Canto 3, The Yoga of the Soul's Release. Ever his consciousness and vision grew. They took an ampler sweep, a loftier flight. He passed the border marked for matter's rule, and passed the zone where thought replaces life. Out of this world of signs suddenly he came, into a silent self where world was not, and looked beyond into a nameless vast. These symbol figures lost their right to live. All tokens dropped our sense can recognize. There the heart beat no more at body's touch. There the eyes gazed no more on beauty's shape. In rare and lucent intervals of hush, into a signless region he could soar, packed with the deep contents of formlessness, where world was into a single being wrapped, and all was known by the light of identity, and spirit was its own self-evidence. The Supreme's gaze looked out through human eyes and saw all things and creatures as itself and knew all thought and word as its own voice. There unity is too close for search and clasp, and love is a yearning of the one for the one, and beauty is a sweet difference of the same, and oneness is the soul of multitude. There all the truths unite in a single truth, and all ideas rejoin reality. There, knowing herself by her own termless self, wisdom, supernal, wordless, absolute, sat uncompanioned in the eternal calm, all-seeing, motionless, sovereign, and alone. There knowledge needs not words to embody idea. Idea seeking a house in boundlessness, weary of its homeless immortality, asks not in thought's carved brilliant cell to rest, whose single window's clipped outlook on things sees only a little arc of God's vast sky. The boundless with the boundless there consorts. While there, one can be wider than the world. While there, one is one's own infinity. His center was no more in earthly mind. A power of seeing silence filled his limbs. Caught by a voiceless white epiphany, into a vision that surpasses forms, into a living that surpasses life, he neared the still consciousness sustaining all. The voice that only by speech can move the mind became a silent knowledge in the soul. The strength that only in action feels its truth was lodged now in a mute, omnipotent peace. A leisure in the labor of the worlds, a pause in the joy and anguish of the search, restored the stress of nature to God's calm. A vast unanimity ended life's debate. The war of thoughts that fathers the universe, the clash of forces struggling to prevail, in the tremendous shock that lights a star, as in the building of a grain of dust, the grooves that turn their dumb ellipse in space, plowed by the seeking of the world's desire, the long regurgitations of time's flood, the torment edging the dire force of lust that wakes kinetic in earth's dullard slime and carves a personality out of mud, the sorrow by which nature's hunger is fed, the estrus which creates with fire of pain, the fate that punishes virtue with defeat, the tragedy that destroys long happiness, the weeping of love, the quarrel of the gods, seized in a truth which lives in its own light. His soul stood free, a witness and a king. So, namaste. Salutations to all. Namaste, Jai Ma.